Here's Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, did you go to the Home and Housewares show?
I have reviewed all sorts of stuff from Home and Housewares. Boy, it makes me wish I had a whole other kitchen that I could just outfit, John.
What's the hot product or trend this year?
Well, there's a whole bunch of trends that I think are sort of interesting. Color palettes are changing. So we've been seeing a lot for the last few years of gray and white and black and everything mixed in between. But now we're starting to see some petal soft colors, something called mid-tones, earthen tones. And in fact, the color of the year officially is peach fuzz.
I'm trying to figure out what I know what a peach looks like. So kind of pink orange, kind of
yeah,
that.
Like a pale pinkish orange for sure.
I'm not sure I'm digging that. Like, where am I going to put that?
I don't know. It's a little, it's really interesting. I'm not quite sure why they
maybe
think this is it,
on,
but it's calming colors.
Maybe it depends on how soft it is too. If it's bright orange or pink, I'm not that, but if it's kind of soft, blended into the more white, ecru-ish colors, maybe. I don't know. You said create peace?
Yeah, so the whole idea is peace in your household, I guess, behind the color scheme this year. You know, I'm not really on board with that. I, you know, personally like the bright blue of Le Creuset, but, you know, it's interesting to watch how these colors kind of go and become more muted. And I think what the thinking is, which is interesting because they always put some, you know, kind of verbiage together about why they've chosen this. But the thinking is that now that we're fully out of the pandemic, people want to feel at peace. They want to feel more calm, and more muted colors can help with that.
Well, that makes sense to me. I mean, I don't think that's a stretch. I like the kind of bold colors of Le Creuset, pots and pans, the kind of metallic blue or the orange red. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I want a wall of that. So did they also talk about demographics on some of these trends?
You know, they do. But, you know, again, the people who buy stuff for their house, I think, are the ones, you know, who are a little bit older, a little bit, you know, have the budget. It's a very different thing than when you look at sort of trends across retail where, you know, everybody seems to be going after the 22-year-old who has money rather than the 22-year-old's parents who actually do have all the money.
But that's the truth. I think that about advertising in general. I mean, everybody wants the 18-plus or the 25-34 market. And I'm thinking, I know some 30-year-olds. I have a lot more money than they do. In fact, I'm giving them money. So advertise to 65-year-olds for crying out loud.
Right. The one thing that came out in terms of trends, and I don't think this will be, you know, for anybody who does have a young Gen Z or millennial, this won't surprise you, but they are very focused, these generations, on practicality, sustainability, and value. Whatever they choose to have, they have small places that they live. Their stuff needs to count. And so companies are looking at the fact that future generations, even if there are more of them, won't be loading up their houses with the kind of stuff that we have, mostly because housing is so expensive that the trend is they're living in less with less.
You noted to Pete that there's a set of skillets or pots where the handle folds in so it'll take less space in the pantry.
Oh, gosh. I love these. I actually want to buy some of these. Because,
that's a good idea.
Right? So when you put your pans away, you actually need kind of a big place for them because those handles are so long. And so this company called Lodge Cast Iron has partnered to create this fold bendable handle. It's, you know, Joseph. Created these. The handle folds down. So if you want to stack them in a smaller place that you can, and they can use less storage space, but they're very high quality.
Yeah.
They looked great. It was terrific to see that they had, you could stick these right into the oven, which is kind of nice. I thought they were really nicely done. The other ones that I really liked that came out from Lodge, these are the Dolly Parton cast iron pans. So she's got her likeness emblazed onto the bottom of one of the pan, and there's a pan in the shape of a guitar, which is so awesome.
So I could make a pancake that's, or my eggs could be Dolly Parton shaped or whatever?
Exactly.
the Mind Reels. Anything else you want to tell us about from the home show, the home and houseware show, Elise?
Well, you know, John, nut milks, I have to say that very carefully, nut milks have become a really big thing. So people, more and more people are choosing to go dairy free. And there's a new technology out called Nutter, N-U-T-R. And what it does is make nut and plant-based milks at the push of a button. So I thought this was amazing when I saw it, because basically you add in nuts and water, and out comes a fresh glass of nut milk. You pour it out. It looks like a little, you know, like milk pitcher, actually. It's white. It says Nutter. There's a couple of different settings on the front. And it basically also reduces food and carbon waste. You, you know, get the leftovers. You can recycle those, or you can put them out in the garden. Very, very cool technology. And, you know, I'm not particularly a nut milk fan, for example, but there are so many people who are now allergic to dairy or don't want to eat dairy, or it makes them feel not so great, right? And so this is an easy way to do it if you don't like what you get in the grocery store and you really want to do it yourself with no preservatives. This is the way to do it. It was kind of cool to see.
You're not a nut milk nut. So
not today.
So you put the nuts, like with some almonds, in,
yeah,
and with water.
Yeah, put almonds
and
then water.
What happens? Does it crush it down and chop it up? And then
exactly, and then it strains it.
How long does it take from start to finish?
Like a minute.
You're kidding.
No, it's just like a minute or two. It's really, really fast.
I think it would be like a week and a half to get the moisture out of those things.
Yeah, I don't know how they do this stuff, John. You know, it's wonderful to see.
I think it's fake. I think they're just putting some white powder in there, and you go, oh, I got nut milk. So here's another, though, concern. If that's your choice, and maybe you have a digestive reason to do it, I'm happy this technology exists for you. But I'm worried the amount of water that it takes to make the nuts. I wonder what's more environmentally friendly.
Growing almonds is one of the most, I think I've read, water-intensive things that you can grow. The amount that each tree needs, I don't know if it's like 500 gallons a year or 5,000 gallons. It's some enormous.
Yeah, it's crazy.
A crazy
number. The water per nut, you're like, you've got to be kidding me. There was a whole TV series, and it was just like a fictional, you know, kind of a rancher. It was like Yellowstone about almonds. I'm not kidding.
My goodness.
It was really good too, but I mean it existed on that point. Okay. So this is called Nutter, N-U-T-R. This is a way to make nut milk at home, right?
Correct. And they're taking orders online now. It's thenutter.com, T-H-E-N-U-T-R.com, and they give you a little discount. The Nutter machine, it's 600 milliliters, so enough for a few small glasses at a time. I think they're charging $149 for that. The individual size is $129.
Any last notes from you today?
Well, you know, I think that there were just a whole lot of interesting sort of differentiated things. I think, you know, when you look at what's ease of use, for example, that's coming down the pike, this is kind of a small thing, but they always do some designs with students. And so one of the things they designed was a nicer, faster, sort of better way to put like your tin foil and your saran wrap and one other wrap all together and make it easier to use. Like, I don't know about you, but I always am constantly fiddling with these things, and the little sharp edges to cut the thing, those break off or they don't work right. This all put it together in one nice flat package, and you just stick it in your drawer. And now it's easy to get out all of your, you know, tin foil or your you know, whatever, your plastic.
It's kind of like an organizer, but it slices the pieces as well?
Yeah, it's like a nicer mousetrap for, you know, just stuff that you use every single day.
We need
and I really appreciate that.
The amount of waste in my saran wrap is amazing, because you may come into my kitchen someday and see me kind of flopping on the floor covered in this stuff as I accidentally wrap myself. So is that product have a name, or is there a brand?
It doesn't yet. It's coming. It was one of the students that created it, and
really good for them.
Right. And so there were a whole bunch of wonderful things that they did. And you know what, John? I'm going to create a my newsletter this week. I will put a whole bunch of these individual things from the students. I thought the students, they're all so smart, and I hope they all get really great jobs. They've had over almost 7,000 entries submitted to the competition by students, and they end up with just six or seven a year.
Will this be at thinklink.com?
It will be.
Thinklink.com. That's Elise Glink's website. She's the owner of ThinkLink Media. Nice to talk to you today, Elise.
You too, John.
That's Glink, G-L-I-N-K, thinklink.com. Jim Dahlke joins us most Mondays to talk about some of the things happening in the venture capital and tech sector. And there he is again today. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Lately, though, you've been talking about how venture capital dollars have dried up somewhat, but not so much for the female venture capitalists. Is that right?
Yeah, we're tracking a new report here. And, you know, like we've mentioned, you know, venture capital down really across the board. We saw venture capital fall in the U.S. 30% from 2022 to 2023, 50% from 2021 to last year. So harder to get by, harder to raise funding, a more difficult environment for startups overall. However, some interesting statistics have come through on female entrepreneurs. So women founders actually last year secured a record high amount of venture capital deal value. So they raised about 28% of all venture capital last year, which was a really significant increase from the previous year when it was just about 19%. So that's certainly you know, good news. That does come with a couple of asterisks, though. One, OpenAI has female founders on its team, and it raised $10 billion last year. So certainly when you can raise a humongous deal like that, it'll skew the statistics a little bit. And then the other asterisk here is that companies started solely by women, they received only 2% of all venture capital in 2023. So basically what that says is, all those women founders, almost all of them have a male co-founder on their team. So, the data, while certainly encouraging that female founders are still participating in more of the venture capital deal flow, the data shows that U.S. startups led by only women are far more less likely to attract venture capital dollars unless they have a male co-founder on their team. So a little bit of a glass half full, and also you can see a glass half empty as well.
I don't know why, but I'm reminded of the instances where minority-owned businesses get preferential treatment sometimes in state contracts, and a lot of times you'll find that that minority on the team, that minority, say, co-founder or owner, is sometimes not the principal dollars behind it, but they can be the face of those things. You know what I'm talking about?
That's right. And, in terms of, women businesses that are led only by women, startups led only by women, that 2% number really has barely changed since 2008. So I think that that's really one data point that many folks, kind of within this space would like to see improved. Cause clearly, for women founders to have a male co-founder, raising funding has, so far been much easier with that male counterpart than going at it with just all-female team. So one thing that we'd like to see, some things that are going to change that too are, more women on the venture capital side of the table, right? So seeing more women in venture capital, more women on startup boards. And that's, something that a bunch of organizations nationally, but also here in Chicago, are working on too. So, it's one of those areas you're starting to see some modest growth, some modest improvement, but certainly, we'd like to see some major changes down the road.
You're suggesting that if more women were on the side of giving the money, more women might be getting the money.
That's exactly right. And I think that you see that pay off. There's groups here in Chicago that are tackling that issue specifically, really trying to do a better job of quantifying how many women investors are in town and how many women founders are in town. And when you increase the representation of women within a venture capital firm, does it also increase the number of checks written to women-led entrepreneurs? And so far, it's showing that it does. And I think that those groups would like to see more women being able to write those checks at the venture capital firms, which they expect will lead to more checks written for startup founders.
Speaking of checks, Shark Tank alum PacBack, I'm reading a headline now from your Alex Zorn story, has announced new funding. What is PacBack?
Yeah, PacBack. So PacBack's a kind of a great Chicago startup story and a great pivot story, too. They launched way back when, 2016, or even earlier than that, but, you know, they were on Shark Tank, scored a deal with Mark Cuban for their online textbook platform. This is a business that has gone through many different pivots. They're now an AI company for ed tech. So education organizations, specifically higher education, use their artificial intelligence both for grading for teachers, kind of having like an AI grading assistant for teachers, but also for the students. Now, this is not ChatGPT. They are not writing your term paper for you, but it's basically kind of a writing assistant as you go. So it'll kind of like help evaluate your writing throughout the process before you have to send it to the teacher for grading. And so, it's a really interesting pivot for these guys. And they just raised a pretty good chunk of change. It's undisclosed, but they received a strategic majority investment by PSG Equity, which is a growth equity firm. So more money for PacPac as they look to grow their platform. And they've seen really some impressive growth back to when they were, just launching this platform. They had about 50,000 students using their AI software. They've grown that now to 1.8 million students that have used their AI software. So some nice growth from PacPac and a nice pivot story from a Chicago tech startup.
I suppose a lot of students and teachers listening to us know about that. So it would prompt you like, there's a grammatical error here, or this paragraph doesn't make any sense. I mean, is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, it's grammar and even more than that. So it's really kind of getting into like maybe you're using the passive voice and encouraging you to use the active voice and, kind of really being able to provide more constructive feedback in real time to your writing than simply like, hey, you know, this word is misspelled or this grammar is incorrect. And so really it's kind of providing you the sort of AI writing buddy in real time. And then the professors are able to use it on their end as well, kind of having an AI assistant for grading. So then, you know, the AI assistant is able to kind of take care of some of the nitty gritty parts of your grading. And then the professor is able to kind of take a more holistic look at, you know, what the paper says and provide more, you know, substantial feedback. So really it's kind of a two-sided AI piece here that's able to help not just the professors, but the students. And it's worked out for PacPac.
Jim Dahlke is the national editor at American Inno. You can click on ChicagoInno.com for these and other stories. Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Wintrust Business Lunch continues now. We've got more business news, and this is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago's Celebrity Shoutout Service raised $25 million in new capital last week. Cranes reports the money haul comes as Cameo's valuation fell to less than $100 million. It used to be a unicorn with a $1 billion valuation. The company ran into money trouble but has returned to profitability after slashing costs and cutting staff. Cameo went from 375 workers to just 33 before returning to growth mode. The latest infusion of cash came from Valor Equity Partners in Chicago, a previous investor. The company's founder and CEO says the influx of cash sets Cameo up very well for the long term. Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago President Austin Goolsbee says he expects 3 interest rate cuts this year. His comments during an interview today mirror the Fed's projection of 3 rate cuts this year. Goolsbee stopped short of saying when he thought the Fed would begin cutting rates. The central bank left rates unchanged during its meeting last week. Not all Fed officials are predicting 3 rate cuts. Some are projecting 2 or fewer. The Atlanta Fed president said today he thinks there'll be just 1 rate cut this year. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Time for the business of food now. Here's Steve Alexander.
Hi, it's me, and I've got a message meant only for Taylor Swift. Right after, I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Taylor Swift, here's the message.
We're still waiting.
She is Sarah Reinecke, Vice President of Marketing for Pop-Tarts and other snacks at Kellanova. What she's waiting for is for Taylor to share her recipe for homemade Pop-Tarts. And this all began when Kansas City coach Andy Reid shared this behind-the-scenes tidbit about Taylor with the PFT podcast.
She, she likes to cook, so she made the offensive linemen these homemade Pop-Tarts.
Yeah, I suppose you could call that the wildest dream for Sarah and her marketing team at Kellanova.
When an icon like Taylor Swift ends up in the same sentence with your brand, you need to take it seriously.
So the Pop-Tarts marketing team, operating out of their offices near the Merchandise Mart, seized the moment.
Within 48 hours, basically, of seeing a conversation involving Taylor and Pop-Tarts, we committed to donating to a food bank, and we secured an ad spot in the Kansas City Star asking Taylor to share her recipe to double our donation.
And then
Travis Kelce responded on Instagram.
And Taylor's response?
We're still waiting.
All of this is part of an incredible moment for Pop-Tarts, which is a 60-year-old brand that just keeps cranking out the revenue for Kellanova. And the marketers are trying to make you think of Pop-Tarts as an all-day snack, not just something for breakfast. Another marketing win was the Pop-Tarts College Bowl game, where the mascot, a giant strawberry Pop-Tart, was eaten by the winning Kansas State team.
You know, we talk about, like, we sacrifice everything on this brand for flavor. Why would we not sacrifice a mascot for flavor?
It worked.
The favorite article that we saw in New York Times said, Pop-Tarts Bowl won the internet. So that was the quote that we're the most proud of.
Sarah Reinicke of Kellanova. Taylor, Sarah is still waiting. A Swiftie might say, shake it off. But I'm dying to see how this one ends. On the food calendar, it's National Lobster Newberg Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
If you talk to anybody who works with high school freshmen or sophomores, they will tell you that the pandemic robbed these kids of a couple of years of maturation. And as it turns out, some of the adults in the world are regressing a little bit, too. Laura Dribben is the founder and CEO of Peridius Consulting, and she's been noticing some bad behavior in the workplace, too. Laura, welcome back. How are you today?
Good, John. Thanks for having me back.
What have you noticed? What are we talking about?
So I'm going to start out by telling you that I have worked with remote teams most of my career, and it isn't really until about midway through COVID that we started to notice a difference. A lot more bad behavior that was not in check. Things like a lack of accountability, more passive-aggressive behavior, avoiding meetings sometimes altogether. And we didn't necessarily see what the root cause was until more recently. My belief is that it does have to do with remote work practices. I have seen a change in behavior that I believe, humans are a social being. We a social species, and we have taken some of that connection away by working remote. And so I want to make it clear I'm not an anti-work from home, because I know that's what some might say. I believe hybrid is fine, but it's great for work-life balance, but not necessarily for the business.
How does it manifest itself? What behaviors or lack of behaviors are we talking about?
As I mentioned, a little bit more passive-aggressive. I've seen a number of incidents where people are just sort of taking on the roles that they might want to take on, even though those are not within their realm. And it really comes down to, if you look at the root cause, that it is a regression in how management is dealing with it, how the business is dealing with it. Culture is starting to fall apart. Business culture that companies have spent years and years putting in place, I believe that COVID has sort of torn down some of those constraints that were built in. Things such as when people did act out in the past, people would, the managers would come in and they would have the difficult conversations with their employees. Can't behave this way. It could even go to a continuous observation of a personnel record that it has a longer term effect. And I don't see that happening anymore. Remote work has made it very easy for people to avoid those difficult conversations.
Even though the managers see them, it's easier for the managers to ignore them. You're making this so, however responsible the individuals are for their own behavior, you're working for somebody, they need to steer you in the right direction, or discipline you, get rid of you. So what advice do you have then for the managers who are witnessing this behavior?
Well, I think that, I'll throw out that at first I was worried that this was anecdotal, but then I've seen a number of articles of the LA Times, Business Insider, that has also talked about it. What I'm seeing is companies are addressing it in a manner that I think is ridiculous. They're addressing it by having etiquette coaching, I don't believe it's a matter of people not knowing how to do it. They were fine before COVID. I think it is a matter of that companies have to get back to rebuilding their culture, holding people accountable. The governance of managing their teams has to be put in place, and that accountability is weak in some organizations. Productivity is up, so people say, "Well, look, we're more productive," but it is not necessarily an environment for innovation, which is always important to any corporation.
All right, so we've got a Zoom meeting. We've got a Zoom meeting at 1 o'clock, either in person or on your screen, buttoned up and ready to go at 1 o'clock sharp. And really, people aren't all in place until 1:10. Is that what we're talking about? And then, what do you do as a result?
Well, I think it's actually deeper than just showing up late. I think it's a matter of a lack of accountability for doing the roles that you are being brought on for. So
right.
I think some of that's from bleeding from working from home. You're less formal at home, and now you are some of your behaviors at home are bleeding into work. And I think there's just that we have to get back to the practices that were there before COVID, because I don't think it's an etiquette issue. I think people know how to behave, but sometimes they have to be called on it to remind them that that's not the most productive in a work environment. And managers, sometimes they're that ability to be able to avoid it because I only see them on Zoom, and I don't really want to deal with it then, and they're not going to see them face-to-face for another month, that just ends up as a virus. Because when people see that their counterparts are acting poorly and getting away with it and getting things that they might want that they shouldn't, that isn't productive, it ends up becoming a virus and spreading.
Laura Dribben is the founder and CEO of Peritius Consulting, PERITIUS.com, Peritius.com. Yeah, I'm glad you're on that. We'll talk more about this another day. Thank you, Laura.
All right. Thanks, John. I appreciate it.